I have this quote that a client recently shared with me that I absolutely love, that I feel like summarizes the answer to this. But it's, because there is comfort in knowing you are a normal zebra, not a strange horse. Because you can't find community with other zebras if you don't know you belong. And because it is impossible for a zebra to be happy or healthy, spending its life feeling like a failed horse.
Welcome to Everything is Clinical, a podcast for mental health clinicians. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jackie Dunnigan, a licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm also an AAMFT approved supervisor. And I do believe that when it comes to the therapy room, everything is clinical. I hope you get as much value out of listening to these discussions with various seasoned professionals as I did in having them. Today, we're talking about autism spectrum disorder. Dr. Lisa Corey is our guest. She's a licensed psychologist and the director and founder of North Metro Psychological Services in the Metro Atlanta area. Lisa has been doing assessments for more than 15 years with neurodivergent individuals. And while she was on faculty with Georgia Tech, she developed an assessment program for young adults with anxiety, depression, relational problems, autism, ADHD, and learning disabilities. I'm really excited about her being here today, and I have to tell you, I learned so much from this conversation. I hope you get as much out of it as I did. Dr. Corey, I'm going to get a little less formal here and call you Lisa. I am thrilled to have you here to talk with us about autism spectrum disorder. Do you mind real quick just giving people a little bit of background? I know you are passionate about this topic.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me, Jackie. So my background began in autism and assessment. And that was back way in 2002 with me working with little kiddos with autism, which just really brought that passion about for me. And as the years went on, just being put in different settings where that seemed to be something I gravitated towards. I kind of dedicated most of my career towards just learning more about neurodivergence, learning and how it presents in different populations, how it presents differently in different genders, because there is a lot of difference there in how women present versus men present, and just learning as much as I can from, you know, the professional community, but also from the individuals themselves. That is really, truly how I learned the most, is just hearing clients' stories and their life experience. That has been invaluable for me.
As we were talking and preparing and really the focus on what should the scope of this podcast be, I know initially I gravitated towards the populations I work with, which are adults. But as we were talking, it seemed to me that the best place for us to focus on this podcast was the more general area of what to pay attention to. If you're a clinician, what should you be paying attention to? What might be some indicators that your client might be struggling with? I want to say ASD. Is that the right terminology? Let's first clarify that, because I think the terminology through the years has changed a little bit. So I'm going to pause here for a second and just say, let's clean up the terminology.
Yes, yes.
You're the expert on this. Fill us in on the terminology we should be using.
You know, there has been a lot of changes with that recently. And what I find is that different clients prefer different labels. And so a lot of the movement right now is to use the term autistic. So not individuals diagnosed with ASD. A lot of people are even shying away from ASD, that it shouldn't be a disorder per se. But the way that most people that I find that I see like to refer to themselves is, I am autistic. Autism is the way that I hear most people refer to it. That said, there are still a number of people that even go by ASPE, which is an old term that we no longer have an Asperger's syndrome diagnosis. You know, and so there's a lot of variability there, but I believe the most affirming label for people who are autistic is for us to refer to them as autism, autistic, neurodivergent, but ASD is still widely used as well in the professional community. because, of course, that is an official diagnosis of the DSM that we use. We do say persons with autism diagnosed with ASD. I don't know that that answers your questions very well. There's a lot of variability, but I tend to use the autistic label unless I hear the client using their own label that they prefer to use. And then I just go over that. So it's really meeting where the client is at and understanding there's a lot of communities out there and a lot of different preferences and just respecting that.
Yeah, you know, it can be confusing, but it can be more than anything. I think sometimes it can be a little shaming for us where we're using what we call quote unquote old terminology. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to, like you said, follow the client's lead. Go with where they're going, but never be afraid to ask. So I am going to ask about one of the other terms. To me, neurodivergent is a term that you hear a lot. When I hear neurodivergent, I think of autism. Do you think of just autism, or is it broader than that for you whenever you hear that term neurodivergent? I'm just kind of curious.
Jackie, that's a great question. Because really, yes, a lot of people, they think neurodivergent equates to autism, but it really is a wide umbrella. You know, ADHD falls under neurodivergent learning disabilities. Really, anybody who might think of things differently or experience the world differently, trauma could be considered neurodivergent. So it's really quite a wide umbrella, which in a way, it's like most people out there are neurodivergent in some way, shape, or form, because you know, a lot of people struggle with all kinds of things. But a lot of people, when they hear that term, they immediately do assume that means autism, but really it's lots of different things. People who do have ADHD refer to themselves as neurodivergent too, but it's really a wide umbrella that encompasses all kinds of diagnoses and presenting concerns.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm glad I asked the question. I was a little hesitant. I think so many clinicians think that way, like, you should know this, you shouldn't be asking this question. But, you know, for real, because it has been a term that it seems like in the last few years has just taken off in popularity. Understanding how to use it, I think, is really key. Let's jump into autism. You've made the comment to me that you found that for many people, they'll be working clinically with somebody for quite some time, and that person may not recognize the symptoms. So what should clinicians be paying attention to?
You know, this is a tough question, and I feel like I can talk about this for hours just on its own. You know, you meet one person with autism, it's one person with autism. There's so much variability there. And there's also masking, right? Which is sort of mimicking the neurotypical community or learning all of these behaviors. And so for a lot of adults that most clinicians work with that are maybe on the milder levels of support needed, there's a lot of masking that happens. So there's not necessarily any one thing in particular that you're going to see that the person might do in session, but there are a few cues, a few kind of key things to pay attention to that I think might be helpful. You know, one thing that I find is a very, very common presentation is social anxiety. It may or may not present with you as a clinician, right, where the person might initially feel really anxious with you because they're meeting you, it's a new person, but you'll see it a little bit more widely present in their lives. They might get really nervous meeting new people, especially in groups. Again, with autism, there's a lot to navigate, a lot of social dynamic to navigate in a group setting. So they might be, again, very socially anxious in certain contexts, have trouble meeting new people, you know, maybe avoid social settings as much as they can. You know, so maybe a young adult who's in college is just going to have a lot of struggles with making friends. So that's another thing to pay attention to. Social functioning. Are they able to make friends? Are they able to then keep friends? Because a lot of people who are autistic, they can make the friends. But that further developing part of a relationship, how do you then develop the friendship? How do you maintain a friendship? That might be really challenging. And so there's this pattern of, again, social difficulties and challenges throughout their life. You know, this is another one of those. A lot of people get socially anxious in social situations.
But it is something that with autism is there usually, is what you're saying?
Yes. And it's usually more intense, if you want to think of it that way, where it, again, might really impact a person's functioning. They might not go someplace or go meet new people when they're wanting friends, but they're just so socially anxious that they're struggling to meet a partner, to meet again, to make a friend. So it's going to be a little bit more extreme than just this typical, hey, and of course we all get nervous maybe sometimes when we meet new people. So the social pattern.
So Lisa, am I jumping too far to say that if you have a client who is stating that social anxiety is one of their presenting issues, one of the things that's really getting in the way of their life, that autism at least should start being on your screen of rule outs to be thinking about?
Yes, this is such a great point that you're saying. If that is a major presenting concern, my ears kind of tune up. Okay, let's explore this a little bit more.
Right.
Is it just social anxiety, which certainly could be, or is there more behind that anxiety? You know, and a few questions that I ask of clients is, do you tend to ruminate or obsess about past social interactions? Most of the time, the answer is yes, all the time. And so somebody who's autistic might be still stuck like 10 years ago. They may have had a situation that didn't go well, and they're still ruminating about that. So a lot of that kind of obsessive thinking patterns. And the other question that I ask is, do you tend to prepare yourself? Like when you know something social is coming up, do you try to prepare questions you might ask or conversations you might have? We call it scripting. It's almost like preparing a script or really just spending a lot of energy and time to prepare themselves for this gathering that they're going to, or even talking to a professor. And so this past rumination and then future preparation, those two things are usually present as well.
Really good points. And even as you're saying that, I'm thinking of several clients that I have who have dealt with social anxiety, thinking about it really getting in the way, the rumination, really key. Is there any difference in that area, generally speaking, between men and women when it comes to that particular presentation?
For men and women, I do find that there's not a whole lot of difference there, that both individuals who might be of different identifying gender do the ruminating and the preparing. And some of it, again, has to do with the social anxiety piece, but also the, you know, lifelong social challenges that might have resulted in rejection or being bullied and all these other things. So not a whole lot of difference that I've noticed there with gender.
Yeah, like you said, there's a lot of pieces. Are there any other areas the clinicians should really pay attention to that maybe they oftentimes just totally miss?
The other big area is sensory processing. This is maybe sensitivities to touch, lights, sounds, glows, food textures. This one is a little harder to pick up on, because some clients might say, oh, I'm sensitive, it's too bright in here, or there's a certain scent that might be too strong for them. Or maybe you see them being startled by a certain sound. Of course, with virtual settings, this is a whole different story that's much more difficult to detect. But oftentimes, those clients might not even express that to you. The sensory processing is a really big challenge for many people who are autistic. And so this could be things like being overwhelmed in the grocery store. Like they'll avoid going to grocery stores completely and do delivery, or they'll just go at times when it's least crowded. They might not go out to a restaurant because it's too loud or there's too much going on. A lot of the times with clients, they don't realize they have a sensory sensitivity. They don't even understand what that might mean for them. They just might feel really overwhelmed and they might go into shutdown mode. A lot of autistic individuals refer to it that way, or go into meltdown where they just have a lot of emotions and they don't even know why. And so what I find is when I'm talking to them about some of these sensory things, I'll say, oh, you mean not everybody is sensitive to, you know, these little sounds? Not everybody gets really like enraged or anxious, because you don't know that other people might not experience things in the same way that you do. So a lot of the times I find that they themselves may not realize that they are getting overwhelmed or upset because it's a sensory thing for them.
And I will say, for me, that's one of the areas I always think about when I think about autism is the sensory perception piece of it, that it seems like it just feels like the senses are just turned up. That's my perception. I think those two together are really good pieces of information. I am curious, and this is probably another great big, like, more than podcast question. Are there common myths that you find that clinicians fall into believing about autism?
Yes, this is, again, we could probably spend an hour talking about that. One of the most common things that I hear is, I brought up autism, whether it's to, you know, maybe a primary care physician or maybe even their therapist. And they told me, no, you don't have it because you're making great eye contact, because you have friends. You don't have any social challenges. You're not obsessed with trains. You know, all of these kind of stereotypical things that we usually associate with autism. So a lot of the times it's those things. The myth that people who are autistic don't have friends is really a myth. A lot of autistic people do really well. They find their own communities, people who accept them, people who love them, and they do great socially. So again, it's one of those things that not everybody are gonna kind of meet the same criteria,
right?
Which is kind of the neurodivergent affirming perspective of it, is everybody's life experiences are going to be different. Certainly the eye contact is the most common one, right? That people think of, oh, you know, you're making eye contact. Again, this is going back to the masking. A lot of people who are autistic find it very uncomfortable to make eye contact. But over the years, they learn this is what I have to do. Maybe they've been told, like, hey, you're not looking at me, look at me. And so they have learned to do that. And so they do that very intentionally. So those are, I think, the common ones that I hear. You know, I was dismissed.
And I just want to clarify, when you say masking, the way I'm interpreting that is basically these are skills, so to speak, that people have learned to use to kind of cope with some of these things that may have been deemed unacceptable. Is that a fair way to say it? I mean, you might have a much clearer way.
Yes, that's a wonderful way of saying it. It's, you know, again, it's learning how to behave, right, by observing. Usually it's a lot of, from movies, from books, from observing others, this is what I need to be doing. Usually there's a lot of anxiety associated with that because it's exhausting.
Yeah.
Right. Can you imagine doing that?
That's what I was thinking. All of these scripts running in your head is a lot. It's got to be totally exhausting.
It is.
And such a huge stressor. I would also imagine then, because masking is something that seems like it develops over time as kind of a coping skill, that children probably don't mask as much. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it does develop over time, certainly just through experience of, I said this was not accepted, or I'm doing this and this is not okay, whether it's movement, maybe repetitive movements, right? Fidgeting or shaking your leg, or, you know, that common one, rocking, being told that's not okay, stop doing that, that's weird. And so, yes, a lot of those things develop over time. Those who identify as female at birth in particular, you know, girls are kind of pushed to socialize versus boys who are a little more, it's a little bit more of a different. And so, yes, it does develop over time. And a lot of the times I find that people don't even realize they're masking until they hear that term. Usually they'll say, oh, I heard this podcast. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's me. I didn't realize I was doing all of this. No wonder I hate to socialize. It's exhausting for me. It feels inauthentic. It feels demoralizing. I don't want to do it. But a lot of the times, individuals who are autistic, they don't realize they're doing it until they learn that they're doing it.
Right.
Because they think everybody else is doing it. They think, I mean, not everybody practices conversations. Again, it's one of those things that you don't know until you realize, no, not everybody's struggling so much.
I think that many clinicians probably miss that point of, well, you've developed this strategy, you've developed this skill for compensating, so therefore it's not really an issue anymore, even though the compensation, the masking in itself is a big weight to carry, is part of the issue. So important. One of the things I do want to point out, and I would love for you also to clarify in this point, when we're talking, or when I said earlier, autism should be a rollout, that it does take some special training to actually be someone who does diagnose autism, right? That it is something that as clinicians, we may see and look at and say, well, I think that could be going on. Fill us in a little bit, because you do the diagnosis.
Yes, I do think it's really important to have a knowledge base there and training, because all of these things that we just talked about, right, even sensory things, let's say the social anxiety, you know, we didn't talk about emotional overwhelm, but we can touch on that too. There could be other things that are the underlying cause to that trauma, right, being one of those things. Certainly that could explain some of the sensory things even. So it's really important, you know, again, having a thorough assessment by somebody who is looking at all of these pieces, right? And evaluating, okay, is this autism? Is it something else? You know, what are the rollouts? Because you don't want to label somebody without being 100% certain, because this is a big thing for people. You know, this might be the most important piece of information they've gotten for somebody who maybe is 35 and have lived their life being undiagnosed. So I take that really, really seriously, that giving somebody a label, and it's important that we're all competent and we know exactly the best ways to assess what to look for before we confirm that diagnosis or rule it out.
I know there are some screening tools that you mentioned for clinicians, and even I think you said the individuals can use these. So what are some of the ones that you like that are the kind of first level or layman's, if that's an okay term to use here,
screening tools?
What are some of the ones that you like?
This is for individuals. You know, as clinicians, I think it's helpful for us to maybe, as you are if you're seeing some of these signs, to then say, hey, you know, have you ever considered, I just want to make sure we kind of check this out to make sure it's not something that's an underlying cause to some of your challenges. And it is for individuals. There's lots of screening tools out there. The internet, of course, is full of all kinds of things. And there are some that I really do love to use, especially for adults, that, again, really touch on their experience, okay, their lived-in experiences. The RADS is one. The RITVO Autism Scale is a really good instrument. And I think I gave you, Jackie.
You did. And those I'm going to post, by the way, Lisa, those will be posted in the notes for the podcast.
Perfect. So the RADS is a really great one because it asks questions in a few different categories. It asks if the challenge has been present when you were a child, when you were an adult, or both child and adult. And so what I find is for individuals who have learned to mask and have developed these skills over a lifetime, they'll say, I really struggled with that as a child, making eye contact, but now no issues with it. So it takes into consideration this full scope and what might have happened over the years. I find that to be a really good screener. If you're seeing scores on that and the link that I gave you, Jackie, it will kind of show you this little box with your scores and say, hey, if you're in this range, you know, maybe seek more thorough assessment. And it looks at social relatedness, social communication or language, sensory category, and then restricted interest repetitive behaviors, which is things like, you know, again, the different movements that somebody might make or having hyperfixations about certain things. And so that's a really good tool. It doesn't take very long. It's maybe 15 to 20 minutes for the client. And then you can ask the client to share those scores with you and even talk about some of that and then make a decision. Hey, you know, it looks like your scores are really high on this. You know, it might be warranted that we refer. The other tool is called the AQ, or the Autism Spectrum Quotient. And that is, again, a specific scale for adults that is focusing on all these different challenges and traits and patterns of behavior that are consistent with autism for adults. And it will give you kind of a range and say, hey, above this cutoff, it might be helpful to seek a professional opinion. And I find that that one has been fairly valid, meaning the high scores on that really do most of the time equate to the autism spectrum disorder. And then the other one that I love is the CATQ, or the camouflaging questionnaire, which is meant to assess masking, like all of these different things that an individual might be doing to mask. Because if somebody has really high scores on that, their other scores might be lower, and it's due to the masking.
Oh, so helpful. Do you recommend that people do multiple assessments? Because the masking sounds like that can really kind of throw things. Do you recommend that they do more than one?
Yes, I would. Again, these don't take very long, although some clients do struggle with them. And again, we can have a whole discussion on that where they have a lot of difficulty interpreting the question. Well, sometimes I do. There's so much difficulty with understanding, which in itself is very diagnostic, right? If somebody has so much trouble answering this, which seems to be a fairly simple question. So if possible, I do say, you know, complete these three questionnaires and let's kind of look at all of them and see, are they consistent with one another? Again, are there enough signs there for us to refer?
Perfect. That does get to the big question. When should a clinician refer? At what point do you think they should say, hey, I really think you need to have a thorough assessment and give you a call?
You know, certainly having that initial conversation, as we mentioned, hey, there's some things here, there's some red flags here for this, let's kind of explore this. You know, let's say they do take the questionnaires, you both of you look at them and screening sort of positive. That might be a good time to bring up, what do you think? This is out of my area of expertise, but I really want to make sure we explore this for you. What do you think about potentially looking at this a little bit more deeply? So anytime, again, you notice signs, and then there's some confirmation of those, or when a client brings that up to you, if a client says to you, hey, you know what, I heard this and I so identified with this, I feel like maybe I'm autistic. I think just, again, meeting the client where they're at, affirming them, you know, not, again, we talked about invalidation, no, you're not, because you're making eye contact, but saying like, okay, sure. If you feel like this is something that felt really fitting for you, or you stumbled upon some information that felt very validating, let's refer you. Let's check this out further. And again, some of the signs that we talked about, you know, if you're seeing sensory things, if you're seeing consistent social challenges, if you're feeling stuck in therapy, you're feeling like, hey, we're working on all these things.
Right.
And there just seems to be something that's keeping us from progressing. A lot of the times it's because maybe you're treating a symptom without understanding their underlying cause to the symptom, which can really stall progress. And that could be with autism, ADHD, lots of different things, right? So I feel like anytime there's this inkling that you have, this might be a case for my client, whether because you see it, because the client brings it up. Of course, being who I am, I highly believe in assessment. I think it's an incredible tool for therapy that's so important to guide us as clinicians, but also for clients to get knowledge. I think knowledge is power.
And I know you've said too, and I've heard this from other clinicians who specialize in assessment, that I think anybody who's been doing this work for any amount of time knows that clients oftentimes get great relief in identifying what it is, in being able to kind of put a box around it. And it's like, oh, it all makes sense. I do kind of wonder, you know, full disclosure, I'm going to put myself out there as a clinician. I work just with adults and kids in family settings, but primarily I work with adults and a lot of couples. One of the things I always look at is, well, what would the benefit really be for the adult to go through the formal assessment? And I want to toss that question over to you, because I know my mind has been changed through having a lot of these discussions with people really on the other side of the assessment and people who have gone through the process. But I'm curious from your standpoint, because I do think with children, it seems much more obvious, the need for the assessment in getting some educational support, some other tools, getting therapy going the right direction early on. What are your thoughts of the benefits for assessment?
Truly, I do think that, as you mentioned, you know, like, what is the benefit, right? And sometimes clinicians are almost maybe hesitant to bring up a label, whatever that might be, whether it's a personality disorder or autism, right? Because they're thinking, well, how is that even going to be helpful? The client might react to it in a certain way. So there's lots of sort of these back thoughts that we have. I have this quote that a client recently shared with me that I absolutely love, that I feel like summarizes the answer to this. But it's, because there is comfort in knowing you are a normal zebra, not a strange horse. Because you can't find community with other zebras if you don't know you belong. And because it is impossible for a zebra to be happy or healthy, spending its life feeling like a failed horse.
That is fabulous. I love that. I love it.
Isn't it? It just so summarizes, I think, so many client experiences that I hear. Again, just sense of relief. Like, oh my gosh, my whole life now makes sense. You know, and sometimes that's accompanied with grief. Like, why didn't somebody say this sooner? I could have saved so many years not feeling like a failed horse, but understanding that I'm just a normal zebra, right? So I really love that analogy so much. The benefit is just understanding that all of these lifelong challenges, and I think part of it as clinicians, we sometimes, and I don't want to say underestimate, not sure if that's the best word, but we sometimes don't.
Well, probably a good word.
Yeah.
Probably a good
maybe,
one.
Maybe, yeah. How many challenges somebody who's autistic had gone through throughout their life, whether it's social or sensory. Again, there's so many pieces there, and feeling like they don't belong, like they can never fit in. That's demoralizing. A lot of the times, assigning labels, I'm broken, something is wrong with me, I'm weird, all of these different labels that are really usually negative versus, oh my gosh, I have autism and so do other people. And now I can find a community of people, which is one of the big benefits, right? Maybe finding support groups or even friends, you know, making friendships with other neurodivergent individuals where they can really feel like they can be authentic and they can be themselves. So that's the biggest benefit, I feel like, truly, is that knowledge and sense of relief. More times than not, clients will feel just like this. And it's tears, but tears with like relief versus things that we might imagine that clients might experience. Other things, if there's academic or work accommodations needed, there might be certain things that clients are struggling with in those settings. And they could really use accommodations, but sometimes they don't even realize it. It's similar to, like, an ADHD learning disabilities. And there are a lot of resources out there. There are a lot of accommodations, especially in work settings for adults. And so that's another benefit, is just access to those. You know, also information, realizing, oh, sensory stuff, I didn't realize that was a thing. Oh, executive functioning stuff, I didn't realize it. And so then seeking out information about that, learning more about it, and then using that information to take better care of themselves, right? It's all about this journey of self-knowledge and self-improvement, which is why people come to therapy. So I really do feel, you know, the benefits are, there's so many.
Oh, great information. A lot of the clinicians that I supervise, that I work with, there's so much focus, particularly with postmodern therapy models of do not label. That so many clinicians have moved towards do not diagnose. And that may be a bit of an overstatement, maybe. Certainly, we don't want to label people. There's a difference between labeling people and giving people information that can be very freeing for them. And some people will choose to take that label and say, I'm autistic. Others may say, I struggle with autism. I think it's really important because I just think it is something that I've seen. I'm getting a little on my soapbox here a little bit. I shouldn't, but it is something that we have to, I think, as clinicians, be really sensitive to. Are we using the no labels platform to get out of some of the diagnosis piece that we really need to do good work?
I love that, Jackie. I really love that. And I don't think it's about the label. It's about the understanding, right? Which sometimes comes with the label. You know, we can talk about the medical community, right? If you don't know you have diabetes and you're struggling with symptoms of it, what does not having a label in that case mean, right? And we can equate that to many other
right.
conditions. I hear this from parents all the time. Oh, I didn't want to diagnose my son when he was 10. I didn't want to put a label on him. So as a result, the child has struggled, didn't get the interventions that maybe would have been really helpful. And now they're coming to me, and it's a 22-year-old who's having a lot of trouble transitioning into adulthood and is really anxious and depressed because they're struggling socially, because they feel like they don't fit in. So instead of having a label of autism, which would have helped, right, and helped with the acceptance piece and the intervention, now this person feels awful about themselves and they're anxious and depressed and they have trouble functioning. And so I do hear that a lot because I see a lot of young adults that parents bring in I didn't want to label them. Or I took them to all these different professionals and nobody said anything. You know, so there's all these different kinds of stories. I hear what you're saying at the labeling piece and just like, let's stay away from it. But again, for artistic individuals, what I hear is that it's freeing and that it allows them to then find a community and just gives them all of this information and ability to reframe their life in a much more positive way. So I do think labels are powerful for that reason.
I think that you're spot on with that. Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you feel like clinicians need to be aware of?
You know, one thing that, you know, when we first began talking about different signs, I feel like one of the big ones that I didn't mention is the emotional regulation piece. Certainly that's associated, right? Autism is associated with intense emotional responses. And so one of the things that as a clinician, you might see even in session, maybe responding like very frequent crying, just becoming easily dysregulated to relatively small triggers, but also just, again, a lot of emotional dysregulation outside of the session, maybe having periods of shutdown where they feel like, hey, I just have to isolate. I can't talk to anybody. There's a lot. Or meltdown, where the person, again, is just maybe gets very expressive or maybe angry, anxious. So that's a really big piece there for the emotional regulation, because that's something that I see very frequently. And some of it, again, has to do with it's secondary to the autism piece, meaning, again, because there might be sensory things or other things that they're just having a lot of trouble with emotional regulation, but it's not necessarily progressing in therapy. You would expect that too. They're just not responding to all of these skills or tools you're giving them because, again, there might be some underlying issue that's causing that. So I just wanted to touch on that because I do think that's kind of an important sign to look for as well.
I agree. And, you know, one of the things, Lisa, you know, that I'm a couples therapist. And going back to what we just talked about a moment ago, having the diagnosis, having that awareness can help the couple so much make sense of there is something here that's making it harder for that individual. And it's not about, you know, because when we're in a relationship, we tend to take things yes. personally. It's not about the other person. It's not about us. And it can really, really help to move things forward. But I like that you brought that piece out because I think that is a good one for clinicians to certainly keep in mind. Thank you so much for going through so much information in a relatively short amount of time. I know there's a lot more to cover. You know, I have to put this out there when I asked you if you would do the podcast that you said, I don't typically do things like that, but you're passionate about this. And I think it's wonderful. And I'm sure it shows up in your clinical work as well. So thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Music for this podcast has been provided by Audionautix.com. This podcast is purely informational and is not a replacement for supervision. Thank you for listening.